we had last week. We actually took a couple of questions from the live stream audience, and they're hoping we're going to be able to do that here. Although I think it's important to give this class the priority. So one rule I'm going to suggest is that we take a maximum of just two questions from the virtual world. And so if there's a good question coming out there, let us know, but it's going to be limited to two. And if that's too much, let me know. We can limit it to one, but I think we'll try with two and to see how that goes. But yeah, we're getting some very good feedback on that. Thank you for the class that you led on navigating Genesis. I can tell you did a really good job just because they were engaged. Very engaged. And I see Ross Hoagland somewhere here in this class. There he is. Ross, how many groups have you taken through navigating Genesis so far?
Four
groups. So hey, just because you've done it once doesn't mean you can't do it again. And whenever I've taken a group through, I always try to challenge people in the group. You can launch your own group. And so I can't do this. Says, yeah, all you need to do is turn on the DVD player. Because basically it teaches itself. So I encourage you to take advantage of that.
Dr. Ross,
yes.
I missed your program yesterday.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that. I was on the Moody Broadcasting Network yesterday morning. And, I'm sorry you weren't able to make that. I was going to give a brief report on how that went. It was an hour-long debate on the age of the Earth. And the fellow I was debating was the one that funded and wrote the script for Genesis history. So, I did get to see the DVD ahead of time. So, and I also had a two-hour conversation with that gentleman, Tom Porforoy, actually before the theater release of the movie. And, he is a very convinced young Earth creationist. He's got a history degree, and I found out in the debate that he actually wrote the script. So, 'cause I was wondering why these scientists and theologians that he was interviewing, people I know, were, saying things I didn't think they would say, but evidently it was all scripted. So, in fact, one of the young Earth creationists that was interviewed, Paul Nelson, actually, after the movie was released, he posted an article basically saying they misrepresented me. Because what disturbed him, and I know Paul Nelson, unlike most young Earth creationists, he's friendly towards those of us who have an old Earth perspective. And he says what the movie did is it presented a false dichotomy, basically saying you, the viewer, have two choices, young Earth creationism or evolution. It's like he didn't offer any other alternatives. I was pleased that Paul actually pointed that out. That was good. But I also saw several other false dichotomies, that the only way you can read Genesis's history is from a young Earth perspective. And all of you in the class know we definitely teach it, that it is historical. In fact, what was interesting is Tom claimed there's no way you can do this, keep it as history from an older perspective, because you got the sun showing up after plants on the fourth day. And I says, well, go back to Genesis 1:2. It gives you the frame of reference for the six creation days. And, your issue is that you have the frame of reference above the clouds. If it's below the clouds, the sun's not created on the fourth day. It's created before the 6 days, and the sun's light becomes visible on day one. And notice the text says, let there be light. It doesn't say God created the light. Now, it's quick to add, I do believe that God created the light, but that was Genesis 1:1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And it's interesting to understand how many young earth creationists actually don't recognize that the phrase, the heavens and the earth, Shamayana rests in the Hebrew with a definite article, means the whole universe of matter, energy, space, and time. It's not the stars plus the earth. It's actually a phrase that's used for the whole universe based on the fact that in biblical Hebrew there is no single word for the universe. And incidentally, biblical Hebrew, because of its small vocabulary, frequently will use phrases for things in English that we have a single word for. And so every time in the Bible it says the heavens and the earth, it's referring to the totality of physical reality. It's used 9 times in the Old Testament and is never isolating the earth. It's always focusing on everything, all matter, energy, space and time, stars, galaxies, light, electromagnetism, gravity, everything is all included in that term. You will see a contrasting phrase, heaven and earth. That shows up 19 times in the Old Testament without the definite articles. It says heaven and earth. And that's a reference to the whole physical universe plus the spiritual realm where the angels dwell, where God operates. So it's basically a bigger term than just the universe. Heaven and earth means all of the universe plus everything in the spirit realm that God has created. Yes?
In your debate, how was his attitude?
Well, it was a lot better than the two-hour private conversation I had with him. Because the two-hour private conversation I had with him, and I was basically trying to appeal to him and say, look, if you're going to release this movie, at least let the audience know there's more than two positions, because I heard it was going to be presenting young Earth versus evolution. And he was quite insistent, well, those are the only two real options that you've got. I mean, I'll tell you some of the more false dichotomies I saw. You know, one was that you can only see Genesis' history from a young Earth perspective. And interestingly, I don't think you can see it as history from a young Earth perspective. It's got real problems trying to look at Genesis' history from a young Earth perspective. From the very fact that he pointed out, you've got plants in their perspective before the sun exists. Well, how do you keep the plants warm? Now, in debates I've had with them, they says, well, God shines light on the earth, and that's what keeps the plants going. And I says, well, I could see God shining his Shekinah glory upon the earth before the sun, and that would provide light. But, you know, it's got to also provide heat, and it's got to be just the right electromagnetic spectrum coming out of that Shekinah glory, because after all, you've got to sustain this photosynthesis. But it's also got to be artificial gravity, because you can't really sustain the earth and its life without the gravity of the sun. And now you've got the problem. At one point, God takes away his Shekinah glory with the gravity embedded in it by some weird means. And then you've got to replace that with the sun and all the other planets. And that can't disturb life that's already existing on the earth. So moving God, he says, well, God can do anything. He can. But there's nothing in the biblical text that says that God intervene and put a sun in place where there was no sun. Or as I pointed out in my book, A Matter of Days, the young Earth model is really a two-sun model. Because the sun, the light that they got up until the fourth day has to be identical to all the characteristics of the sun. So you can call it God's Shekinah glory, but physically it must manifest all the attributes of the sun. And then you have this sun number one for the first three creation days, then you'd have God taking away that A and replacing the sun we have right now. And that seems a bit contrived. And again, there's nothing in the Bible that suggests that God ever did that. Yes?
I'm curious what their answer would be to the following chronology. Adam is 2004 BC, according to okay, so if you use the genealogy as contiguous, meaning there's no gaps. You get down to Noah and the flood. Well, Noah got out of the flood at the end of the flood at the year around 2358. That means 30,000 species of animals, which they tend to use that number, that could be on the ark, instantaneously evolved into millions of species by the time of Abraham. And the population couldn't expand in 300 years to Abraham's time to millions of people. How do they deal with that?
Well, that's actually going to be coming out. I mean, you know, I did this debate, but at the very end of the debate, I told the audience, there's a four views coming out. So you won't be getting this false dichotomy, there's only two positions. You're actually going to see a four views book written by the president of BioLogos, representing evolutionary creationism, the president of Answers in Genesis, that's Young Earth Model, the president of the Discovery Institute, Steve Meyer representing the intelligent design movement's position, and then yours truly got to represent the old earth view. And that was the subject of what was there. And what I liked about this book is coming out from Zondervan, and they did everything they could to try to maintain a gracious tone throughout the book. But that subject did come up. And I knew ahead of time how young earth creations respond to it. But you'll actually see this. I said, we're not advocating evolution. We're advocating diversification. However, their definition of diversification is indistinguishable from the definition of, you know, a Darwinian-type evolutionary process. And yeah, you're making a good point. And this has been brought up by several atheists, some of which I cite in A Matter of Days, where they basically said the degree of biological evolution that is needed to sustain the young earth position is tens of thousands, if not millions of times more aggressive than anything we atheists have ever proposed, because of the fact of how rapidly you got to get all these. But the young earth response is saying, we believe Noah took on board the ark two of every kind, but each kind would be a family or an order. And so, for example, there would be a single cat pair on board the ark. And after the flood, the single cat pair rapidly evolves into all the feline species we see on the face of the earth. And likewise, there'd be a single horse type that would be on board the ark. And after the flood, that single horse type would rapidly evolve into zebras donkeys, horses, and all the other equine-type creatures. It's still very aggressive. And of course, they claim that there's no carnivores until after the flood. And so you have these animals rapidly evolving, carnivorous. And they claim, for example, well, they had teeth like carnivores before the flood, but they were eating vegetables. And then after the flood, they just used that same teeth to eat animals. But what they're overlooking is this. It's not just the claws and the teeth. A far more challenging problem is the fact that the intestinal tract of the predators is radically different than that of the herbivores. And so you really are looking at a radically different animal. You know, for example, a shark, a third of the body weight of a shark is its liver. Because after all, it's eating predominantly fat. And so it needs this gigantic liver to be able to process its extremely high animal fat diet. And, likewise, all the cats. The cats are not capable of eating a vegetarian diet. So a dog can. I mean, you can kind of feed a dog, you know, concentrated rice dog biscuits, and it can make it because it has a longer digestive tract than the cat. But if you give a cat a purely vegetarian diet, it will die. It needs meat. So... That's correct.
God rested from his creation activity in the first week of Genesis, so it was by evolutionary means.
Well, to push their argument, they actually argue that God designed these kinds with a super genome that was designed to rapidly diversify into thousands of different species. Now, Fuzz Rana has commented on that in a couple of articles that he read, is that they're overlooking the genetic impossibility of having this kind of super genome that could rapidly diversify without causing widespread extinction. So, but
the Egyptian Empire was in the 2300s.
Well, okay, one thing I've brought up, because I mean, Tom Porphyroy was not aware that I personally debated a lot of the young Earth creationist scientists that he had interviewed. And there's one reason I quickly picked up this must have been scripted, because the ones I knew all admit that the science is overwhelmingly against their position. And yet when they were interviewed for this theater movie, they were basically implying all the science is on our side. And so, and my comment was, you know, you can do, and the movie came across as a documentary, and it's like, you can do that in a documentary if no one is disputing your conclusions. Now, it is quite appropriate for some expert to be interviewed in a documentary and say, this is the way it is. However, it's considered unethical, if not dishonest, if you're promoting a view that doesn't have any disputed, to always represent, well, there is another position. And that was never done in the movie. It wasn't even done in the theology. You know, I was quite surprised. They interviewed this theologian, and I think he was taken out of context as well, because he was basically saying the only way to read the creation days in Genesis 1 is that they're 24 hours. And I've never heard a younger theologian say that. They all admit there's different ways. They just say theirs is the best way. But they basically are saying there's only one possibility. And so, yeah, the movie is fraught with false dichotomies. At the very end, I heard they're going to do a sequel. This guy has lots of money, so he's going to be bringing out a sequel where they're basically going to kind of push the point that, hey, all the science is on the side of the young earth position. And because it was a very short one-hour debate and there was ads ahead to run and you get cut off a lot, I didn't have the opportunity to make the point. You know, in debates I personally have had with young earth creationist scientists, there was two of those debates where the moderator asked this question: do you know if any scientist who's ever been persuaded that there's credibility to the young earth position independent of a Bible interpretation? And though the debates, that's with Duane Gish and John Morris, and both of them said no. And the moderator came back with Duane Gish, says, hey, you've been doing this for 40 years. You mean in a 40-year period, you can't name or think of a single one? He says, no, I can't. And the moderator said, look, I don't know anything about the science, but I know right away this position does not have scientific credibility, because there'd be at least one who, independent of a Bible interpretation, had drawn that position. Yes?
Did they touch at all on scripturally? Doesn't Adam, before the fall, give names to the creatures that are really kind of based on their carnivorous nature? And did they ever come off as barring access, if you will, to reference to Psalm 104 or Job in terms of content within the Bible?
Again, it was just a one-hour debate, and we probably addressed that subject for all of 20 seconds. So, yeah, and then the subject got changed. So, no, we were not able to go that far with that. Or the fact that this isn't a matter of days, is that they make the claim, we're not talking species, we're talking biblical kinds. But what's interesting is that the Hebrew word min, that's translated as kind, actually is defined exactly how broadly that can go. So, for example, I think it's in Exodus and Leviticus, it talks about six different kinds of owls, which means that the definition, at least as it applies to birds, is really as narrow as a scientific definition for a species, if not narrower. However, you will find, again, this is in the Torah, I'm trying to remember the exact text, I think it's Leviticus, actually names four different kinds of winged insects. And there it's using a broader term, a term that's as broad as a genus. So based on the biblical examples, maybe you could push the boundary of a biblical kind as far as a genus for insects, but for birds and presumably mammals as well, it be as narrow as the equivalent of the definition for a species, which means it's not God just taking a single pair from each order or family and filling out the entire thing through rapid, quote, diversification. But we never got to discuss that. But I did get to dialogue with that in some televised debates we've done, and it's in the book A Matter of Days.
But Adam gives names to, like, the
whole. He does, yeah. I mean, yeah, there's good refutations to this. So, but, you know, the real core of this discussion I had yesterday was over the issue of death. Because the moderator is saying, well, you know, this really isn't a salvation issue, but your passion, referring to the young earth defendant, you must think this is a very important doctrine. He says, yes, I do. Because in Hugh's perspective, you got plants and animals dying before Adam sins. That besmirches the character of God. And he actually tries to tie the doctrine of atonement into the death of these animals. And so we talked a little bit about that. and basically said, well, the biblical text simply rules out human death. It doesn't rule out plant and animal death. And he did concede that point. He says, yeah, the Bible is silent on it, but just based on what we know about God and the Bible, there couldn't have been any plant and animal death before Adam. And my response was, well, God wanted to redeem billions of human beings in a short period of time. That requires a lot of biodeposits. Tens of quadrillions of tons of biodeposits are necessary for billions of human beings to be redeemed in a short period of time. And we have that thanks to the death of plants and animals and other life forms taking place over billions of years. So there's a question here. Yes. Then I'll come back to you.
Real briefly, in terms of evangelism, when I'm online debating with, not debating, but sharing with atheists, they think they're debating me, I have to spend so much time, you know, just dispelling this reputation that Christians have of believing all this young earth stuff, you know? I mean, it seems like you almost have to throw out almost all of science to believe this.
Well, let me give you... Let me give you an extreme example of that, Doug, but it's actually pretty common. I was doing a debate with an atheist quantum physicist at the University of Alberta, Calgary. This was quite a few years ago. And I got to speak first, and I kind of laid out, you know, here is the scientific evidence for the God of the Bible. And then when the atheist quantum physicist got up, he basically said, everything you hear Hugh is saying, he doesn't believe. I know he's a committed Christian. He believes the Bible is the error-free word of God. Therefore, he can't believe what he's saying. He really is a young earth creationist. And so he spent his 30 minutes explaining why young earth creationism is scientific nonsense. And but fortunately, I had a chance to respond and say, you know, I really do believe... that this and that, you know, the young earth creations are really, from my perspective, misreading the Bible. But it does show you. And he kept insisting to the audience, Hugh must be young earth because he takes the Bible seriously. And he's a serious Christian. And so you're right, Doug, there is this widespread perception that if you take the Bible seriously, you have to be reading it from a young earth perspective. And this is where I appreciate the scholarship of Gleason Archer, you know, the famous linguist and theologian, where he basically argued it's not possible to defend an inerrant Bible from a young earth perspective. And that the problem, and I got to say this yesterday, I said, you know, it's not enough to take the Bible literally. We have to take it literally and consistently. There's 66 books in the Bible. And how we're going to biblically resolve this age of the earth issue is by looking at all the biblical texts. And the moderator said, give me an example. I said, well, it's one I gave here in the class, Jeremiah 33. The laws that govern the heavens and the earth are fixed. They don't change. If you look at the whole chapter, God says to the Jews, you're always changing your mind. I never change. I am immutable. As proof that I'm immutable and changeless, look at the laws that govern the heavens and the earth. As they don't change, I don't change. And her comment is, what has that got to do with this age of the earth? And I says, well, talk to any young earth creationist, and you actually heard it here today. All young earth models depend on radically altered laws of physics, either at the fall or the flood, or typically both. And we're not just talking a slight adjustment, we're talking adjustment in the case of the flood of a factor of a billion times. And they all admit that that poses a problem for them. And, you know, Marcus Ross was interviewed in this theater release movie. And I had a chance to dialogue with him and debate him publicly when I was in Missouri. And he points out, yes, we got big problems with our global flood model because we have to have the radiometric decay rates about a billion times faster for a five-month period. And there's a lot of potassium in the bodies of human beings and all other life forms. And if that potassium decays a million times faster, then that's going to incinerate the bodies of every animal on the face of the planet. And never mind the uranium and thorium we got in our bodies. So, but anyway, interesting time. And we did take a couple of questions. Interestingly, an astrophysicist called in with his question. And he said, you know, tell me about the craters on the moon. And he was making a good argument that you can't really explain the craters on the moon from a young Earth perspective. Unfortunately, he didn't have time to unpack his whole point, and he was assuming that everybody knew enough of the physics of crater formation that they were following his argument. And you know, kind of typical of a lot of my astrophysicist friends, they assume that lay people know too much. So, but it is a powerful argument because of the fact that we can actually see that the craters on the moon are eroded. You can actually see the erosion. In fact, by measuring the erosion, we can tell when those craters had formed. And the forces of erosion on the moon are orders and orders of magnitude less than they are on the Earth. And so when you see a heavily eroded crater, in fact, 95% of the craters we see in the moon were formed 3.9 billion years ago. That's where we get our evidence for what's called the late heavy bombardment. The fact that we can see in the moon that almost all the craters were formed at a particular epoch, and consequently planet Earth took 30 times the damage that the moon took because of her bigger gravitational signature, which is a huge part of our origin of life model, it reasons to believe. But it's thanks to the craters on the moon we're able to figure that out. And also, the moon's got an argon atmosphere. You know, when potassium decays, it makes argon. And all the argon only comes from potassium decay. And so for the moon to have an argon atmosphere, it had to be there a long, long time. Otherwise, there'd be no argon there if it was only 10,000 years old, because of how slowly potassium decays. Yes? The young come to you. I didn't forget you.
Thank you. What is the name of the movie?
Is Genesis History. They're coming up with a sequel. And I've heard there's another young Earth movie that's going to be released tomorrow in theaters. Tomorrow and Thursday. I'm probably not going to get to see it because I got to get on an airplane and head to Rhode Island to speak at a conference. You had a question?
Exactly the same question.
Yeah.
What's the name of the movie? Yeah.
What's the name of the movie? Is Genesis. You can watch it on Netflix.
Yeah, I just hadn't heard that mentioned all day. There's
Sorry. No, it had a two-day theater release a couple of months ago, maybe longer than that, but recently. And yeah, now I hear they're doing a sequel to it. So,
do you know what the response was? No.
Well, the theaters were packed, but they're basically packed with young Earth creationists. So they're basically hearing what they wanted to hear. But I think what's unfortunate is they're basically hearing all the theology is on our side, all the science is on our side, all the scientists out there don't know what they're talking about. And I shouldn't say this. I'm going to cut it off right there because I was going to say something personal, but I won't. Okay? But yeah, I'll just close with this. The real heart of our debate yesterday is a good God would not let plants and animals die unless it could be blamed on human sin. And you know, theologically, that's got a problem for me. It's like, you mean to tell me that God is handcuffed because of our human actions? If this is the all-powerful God, and if this is such a horrible thing from his perspective, why would he be taken back or put on surprise because of a human response? After all, we're just a creature, and he would know what we're going to do anyway. But, you know, the point I've already made is it's thanks to the death of plants and animals that billions of us can be redeemed in a short period of time. And given the laws of physics, there really is no other way. But I do find it frustrating when I dialogue with these young Earth creationists. They think physical death is bad in all contexts. And it's like, if that's the case, God would have given us access to the tree of life. But notice what happened when Adam and Eve sinned. God sent two powerful angels with flaming swords to block access to the tree of life. Why? Lest they live forever physically. You see, theologically, what's going on there? If we humans had gotten access to that tree of life, we would have lived forever physically and have been spiritually dead for all eternity. Because God took away access to the tree of life, God now was able to use our physical death as a tool to redeem us from something far worse, spiritual death. And it's thanks to physical death a pathway has been opened up for the redemption of human beings. And if we think that death is bad in all contexts, how do you explain the fact that God, before he created anything, chose that his own son would die on the cross on behalf of all of us? So before God created anything, the physical death of the creator of the universe was already put on the calendar. This is what we're going to do. The Godhead had agreed to this plan before they created anything at all. Moreover, as you read the New Testament, especially in the epistles, you see the repeated point to the human species. If you want to truly live, the only way you can truly live is to die. And so coming to Christ is basically agreeing to die to self so that you can live eternally. And so death is a pathway to life. And in that sense, I think we're mistaken to say that death is evil in all contexts. I think there was someone here that had a question. If not, I'll go to you. Go ahead. Well, what I've heard from my young earth friends is they'll say things, well, we're not talking plants, because plants really aren't alive. It's basically just the animals we're talking about. And then they'll say, well, just the higher animals, the animals that can feel pain, because after all, God would never cause any creature to experience pain. And they would claim things like cockroaches don't experience pain, frogs don't experience pain. However, there's abundant scientific evidence that they do.
Cockroaches, I can believe it.
Well, there are papers I cite in a matter of days making the point that they've done experiments on frogs, and they experience fish and frogs. So, you know, when you take that hook out of a frog, it feels pain. So, likewise the frog. And they basically feel it to the same degree we do, with one exception. They don't anticipate it. And this is something I think we need to be careful about. You can't interpret the pain of an animal from a human perspective, because we know pain is coming. I mean, it's called the dentist effect, right? When you go to the dentist, you anticipate that you're going to experience pain, and it makes the pain much worse. It's the anticipation of pain that makes the pain worse. And animals typically don't anticipate pain. In fact, my son had to take his dog to the vet this morning. The dog had quite a terrible urinary tract infection. And I was going through pain. But it's like my son's comment is, my dog just isn't responding. And I said, well, dog is not like you. If you had the same problem, you'd be in agony. Moreover, you'd be in agony thinking, I've got to go to the hospital. I know what I'm in for. Your dog doesn't know what he's in for. And so is able to respond to the situation with a lot more calmness than you would as a human being. So, yes.
You gave us something I saw in the windowsill of my studio. A spider and a fly. The spider had his web already made, and the fly was on the opposite side of the windowsill. So the spider went over, and he would sting the fly. And then he would go back, and he continued to do this until the fly stopped wiggling and moving. And then he wrapped him up in and took him back into the... So the spider must have been smarter than the fly. Is that correct?
Yeah, I would say that. At least that particular fly.
Anyway, it was fun to watch that.
Yeah. And, well, this is... something too is if you go back 150 years, you don't see this young earth, old earth debate over death like we do today. In fact, our scholars at Reasons Believe have said it's basically an urban phenomenon. The young earth creationists that take this perspective, they've been born, raised, and educated in big metropolitan cities, whereas people who live on the farms and out there in the rural areas, they recognize how essential it is that there be the process of physical death. I mean, if you don't thin out the deer, for example, their death rate's going to go up. And that's what the carnivores do. And the carnivores are very efficient. They only hunt the sick, the wounded, and the dying, or the crippled. And this actually increases the health of the herd and actually increases the population. So I've gotten to say this in a couple of debates. You take away carnivorous activity, the death rate will skyrocket. And there's lots of documented evidence of what happens, especially in Australia. Yes?
You mentioned the tree of life, and that's an interesting thing. I don't know if you've written on that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, kind of theorize exactly what that was and how that fits into this whole concept of the young elder. Have you any comments?
Yeah, I do. I comment on that in a matter of days, making the point that Romans 8 makes it clear. And that actually came up in the debate yesterday because he was basically misinterpreting Romans 8. He left out a phrase. And frequently I see that with my young earth friends. They'll quote a Bible text, but they leave out a key phrase. And the phrase he was leaving out is that creation is subject to the law of decay. And he was implying it's subject now, but it wasn't before. And it won't be later. Well, if you actually read the passage, 18 to 22, it says the entire creation was subject to the law of decay. And again, in the context of Jeremiah 33, the law of decay has been continuously in effect from the very beginning of cosmic creation. There's always been decay at the same rate it is now, otherwise we wouldn't be able to live. I mean, the idea that you could digest food without a pervasive law of decay. I mean, you've got an engineering degree. What you learn in engineering is, you know, life vitally depends on the law of entropy being continuously in operation. And so Adam and Eve were under the law of decay before they sinned. And likewise, they're experiencing pain. And the Bible actually has some passages where it talks about what it's like when you don't experience pain. You know, lepers. The problem with leprosy is you lose your sensation to pain. And that's, you know, when you look at lepers who have lost limbs, it's not because a disease caused those limbs to drop. It's because they lost their pain sensation in those limbs and wound up doing injury to those limbs to such a degree that the limb basically was decayed and gone. And so I've actually seen people with that disease say, well, give me a jar. I'll get that lid off. They don't use a wrench, because they experience no pain, but then you see this huge bloodied scar on their hand because they really basically don't experience any pain. My position on the tree of life is that here's Adam and Eve in the garden, and they're enjoying life, but after about 20 years, they begin to notice, our bodies are a little bit decayed, and it's actually causing us some discomfort. Let's go to that tree of life, and it's basically kind of like taking a pill that reverses all the effects of thermodynamics. So in other words, this tree of life basically would kind of renew things. It actually says that in Revelation 21, how there'll be a tree of life for the new nations that God will create in the new creation, and it will be a healing thing. In other words, it'll be able to reverse the impact of the law of decay. And so without access to the tree of life, there's no reversing the law of decay. Or think of it this way. You take your car into the shop, and they basically fix your car so it's just like it was when it was brand new. That's kind of like the tree of life from my theological perspective.
Is this something physically, you know, realizable, or is this a miraculous thing? And do you have any comments on what this actually could have been?
Well, I think there's something supernatural about the tree of life because it basically reversed the effects of thermodynamics on the human body. There's nothing in there to indicate that it would work for any non-human animal, evidently, and you could claim it does, but there's nothing that would say it would go beyond. So if your dog went there, I'm not sure it's going to restore your dog to its pristine condition, but evidently it works on humans. And that theological perspective tells us that Adam and Eve must have sinned relatively quickly, because if it had been 50 years, they would have gone to the tree of life. But evidently, the time between them being created and their rebelling against God's authority was short enough that they didn't notice any decay in their human body. And that's something you see in 2 Corinthians 4. 2 Corinthians 4 says every one of us as human beings is living under the decay of our physical bodies. But it says if you've got the Holy Spirit permanently indwelling you, that Holy Spirit is kind of like the tree of life. It's transforming you. And what Paul says in 2 Corinthians 4:16, if you're walking in the power of the Holy Spirit, people will notice that Spirit transforming your life day by day. In a single day, they will notice a change. Now, not all of us are walking that way continually, but I'm sure those of you who are believers have recognized when you've met someone where you've actually seen a dramatic change in their spirit, literally in one day. I've seen it with brand new believers, but I've also seen it with people who have been walking with the Lord for decades, where literally in a day you can see this transformation. And it's encouraging because our bodies don't decay in a single day. It takes years before we notice, gee, I'm not walking as fast as I used to. I can't do the stuff I used to do. And I don't look the same as I used to. But it takes years before you notice that accumulated effect. But the Spirit can be a single day. And basically, Paul exhorts us, live your lives in such a way that every single day people can see that you're being transformed. That's what's exciting about being a Christian facing physical death. We can be thrilled about the prospect of a future physical death because whatever is happening to us physically is being far outweighed by what is happening spiritually. And so we can rejoice. That's what it says in 2 Corinthians 4. If you're walking with the Lord, you can rejoice in your old age. Old age is exciting because of what's happening to you spiritually. Totally overwhelms what's going on physically. Yeah, I mean, you're happy, all right? All of those of you who are over the age of 50, aren't you excited? Or I should put it this way. All of you have been walking with the Lord for more than 10 years have probably really seen this happen. You know, married couples where they've both been walking with the Lord for more than 10 years, you can actually be more excited about your spouse than you were when you first got married. To me, that's a sign of a really good Christian marriage where every anniversary is better than the last anniversary. In fact, I'm going to get to do a wedding this coming Saturday. And one of the messages I give when I officiate at a wedding is my prayer for you is that your first anniversary will be a sign, your first year as a married couple will be your worst year as a married couple. And every year afterwards is going to get better and better and better. And so whatever happens in your first year, if you're committed to walk with the Lord, that's going to be your worst year of marriage. Oh, new married couple right here. I hope I'm not discouraging you.
Do you have an opinion view on whether the tree of life was a one-time thing or was it something you would have had to have gone back to regularly?
Well, the text doesn't say. So, I mean, a lot of Bible interpreters have figured it out that way, that the tree of life was something you only had to go to once, and that means you'd be living forever in a perfectly physical state, or it was something you had to go back to repeatedly. In other words, you'd eat of the tree of life, it would reverse all the damage of the laws of physics in your body up to that point. You'd live another 10 years, and you say, well, I think I better go back to that tree of life and get another shot. But that's an open debate within the Christian community.
How would that have mitigated accidental death? I mean, if somebody fell 100 feet, how would the tree of life protect them?
That's also another debate. If you took the tree of life, would that guarantee you wouldn't die from an accident or get shot in a battle? Or does it just simply reverse the effects of thermodynamics in your body up to that point, in which case you would have the potential? And you kind of see that, I don't know if you ever looked at that, what's that series book called, The Lord of the Rings, where they have the elves that can live forever if they don't go to battle. If they go to battle, then they can die. So you can see that debate even within Christian novels. Yes?
Yeah, back on the Tree of Life, God being omniscient, Why did he bother making the tree of life if he knew he would never use it?
Well, I think it was for humanity's benefit. That I was wishing I had a chance to share that yesterday, is that we human beings, in fact, it says that in 1 Corinthians 15, how physical death we view as with fear and as an enemy. And so I think one reason why God may have put the tree of life in the garden was basically to communicate to humanity, I got things under control. You're going to live forever no matter what. And, you know, because we tend to look at death as something very painful. So, I mean, who really looks forward to death? We all know it's not going to be a pleasant experience. But that's why I use the race analogy. If you're running a marathon, you're not going to feel good at the end of the marathon. But when you cross that finish line, you're the winner. And likewise, physical death is a graduation ceremony. But, you know, we shouldn't be surprised that experience of physical death is not going to be pleasant.
Have a moon question.
A moon question.
I had heard that the astronauts at the time of the first man on the moon didn't know how deep the dust was on the moon. They can have a measured rate of how much is on. And they didn't know if they were going to sink 25 feet in or just a few inches. And that's why I took over manual control.
Well, that is a young Earth story that's been propagated for, 50 years. Most young Earth creationists have now stopped telling that story because they realize it's not credible. But the birth of the story was a geophysicist, Hans Pedersen. And what he did is he went to Mauna Kea, one of the high mountains of Hawaii, and he put a filter 4 feet above the top of Mauna Kea. That was before there were telescopes there. This was back in 1960. And he measured the amount of dust going through the filter. And he concluded, if 100% of that dust is cosmic dust, then given the age of the moon, there would be a couple of 100 feet of dust on the moon. And therefore, he said, you know, this is something we need to check before we send people to the moon. Because back in 1960, they were talking about sending people to the moon. And he says, if there's all that dust on the moon's surface, we need to rethink the space program. But what he recommended at the end of the paper was, I did this 4 feet off the top of a mountain. Before we give this any credence, we need to do high altitude balloon measurements and better yet, satellite measurements. Because after all, that dust may be predominantly Earth dust rather than cosmic dust. And that's how we ended the paper. Now, young Earth creationists conveniently drop out the conclusion from the paper. Because what happened long before we sent people to the moon is they actually did those high altitude balloon measurements and satellite measurements and figured out that Hans Pedersen was off by over a factor of 1,000 times. And actually, they were able to work out a detailed model because they found out how little of that dust going through his filter was actually cosmic dust. But they also noted he did not take into account ultraviolet breakdown of the lunar surface. And so that would give you more dust. But because his measurements were off by so much, that would drop the dust down. And so long before they landed craft on the moon, they determined that the average thickness of dust on the moon, if it's 4.4 billion years old, would be 60 millimeters. They said if it's 60 millimeters, then there shouldn't be any problem putting craft on the moon and putting astronauts on the moon. And, you know, when Apollo 9 mission made it to the moon, you saw the astronauts come down the ladder, walking on the lunar surface, and you saw that their tracks were right on the nose. It was about 60 millimeters of dust. And so, but if the moon was only thousands of years old, you wouldn't have any dust. So the fact that it was 60 millimeters of dust shows that indeed it must be billions of years old. But to this day, you've got some young Earth creationists saying there was a dust problem with the moon. And so the fact that there isn't hundreds of feet of dust proves that it's young. It's quite the opposite. Again, what I tell people is when you hear these claims, actually go to the original source. That paper is still available to be read to this day. That's the wonderful thing about the internet. You don't have to go to a university library. You can go on the internet and actually see the paper that Hans Pedersen wrote, and I give you a link in my book, A Matter of Days, so you can go straight to it. That's something else that's new about publishing. A rule we have at Reasons to Believe now, every book we publish has a DOI label that takes you straight to the internet and the article, so that you can actually pop up the book or the article that we're citing and see it for yourself. I mean, that's the amazing thing about the internet. All this stuff is immediately accessible. Now, most of the articles I cite, you will not get the whole paper, unless you're willing to shell out $25. There's a financial firewall. However, you can always read the abstract of any research paper free of charge. And most journals today, once the paper's older than 2 years, they make it free to everybody. And yeah, that paper, 1960, it's way older than 2 years. Okay, in the back. And I'm going to try to get to my lesson, maybe.
Well, in a lot of conversations with younger creationists, yes, their primary issue that they get emotional about is animal death.
That is the emotional issue, animal death. You're right.
They also go to and libel Abraham Lamb. It seems like they're really stuck as well on the model of eternity as being a restored Eden. Would you say that's a fair characterization?
I actually devoted a chapter to that in A Matter of Days, making the point that far more serious than our division over the age of the earth and the age of the universe is our division on eschatology, where they claim, now there are at least one exception. I do know of one young earth creationist leader who does not hold to the idea that eternity will be here on earth, and that what's going to happen is God's going to restore this planet to the conditions it had at the time of Adam and Eve before they sinned. I know of only one young earth creationist that does not hold that view. So, but the one that does not hold that view says, I agree with you, Hugh, this is a very important disagreement, because this really does affect how we think about our redemptive reward. Is it going to be this earth, or is it going to be a brand new realm? And, you know, he's an astronomer, so he realizes you've got huge difficulties if you're going to try to claim that God's going to have us dwell here on Earth for the rest of eternity, because the physics of our planet and our solar system means that the window of time in which we humans can exist here is rapidly coming to a close. I mean, Stephen Hawking is right when he says we're going to have to leave this planet because it's not going to sustain us much longer. Now, when he says 100 years, I think that's a bit pessimistic. We could probably last a little longer, but we're not going to last a whole lot longer than 1,000 or 2,000 years, at least at the state of technology and affluence we're experiencing right now. And even without technology and affluence, this planet will be uninhabitable for human beings, regardless of our population or technology, in about 10 million years. And that's not very long from an astronomical perspective. Well, I mean, I'm millennial, so I believe when it talks about the lion will lay down with the lamb, that's 1,000 years. That's not talking about the eternal state. I do agree that's here on earth. The lion will lay down with the lamb, and the lion will not eat meat. It won't be predatory. What that tells me, however, is we human beings must be feeding all the predators, because they're not going to survive unless we give them a concentrated diet a processed vegetable matter. I mean, you can do that. You can feed a cat if you take vegetable matter, basically concentrate it, put some appropriate amino acids in it, and they can make it. But you just can't give them, tell them to go eat grass. They're not going to, I mean, when your dog eats grass, it doesn't digest the grass. That's to do something else, right? And cats will eat grass so that they can throw up. So, yeah, dogs too, right? So that means we have to be processing, which tells us that I do think you're going to see something like the Garden of Eden, where these animals were not afraid of us human beings. And therefore, there's going to be this capacity to bond with these creatures in such a way that we'll be able to personally feed them the food they need to be able to subsist without killing other animals. And I've actually seen this at the Algonquin Radio Observatory up in Canada, where, you know, it's in an isolated place. It's I tell Americans, this observatory is a place where we had four seasons, just like you have in the United States. We have 2 weeks of black flies, 2 weeks of mosquitoes, 2 weeks of horse flies, and then we got 10 and a half months of winter. Now, it was such an isolated place and a challenging place to live that when they hired the cook, number one, the cook was the best paid employee. He got paid more than the director of the observatory. He got paid more than all of us astronomers. But he also said, I'll only work here if I have an unlimited food budget. And we found out he was throwing away half the food that he was preparing. And so the out back of our telescope, there was this huge pile of waste food that the cook threw away every day. Well, guess what happened? The predators stopped hunting. And you'd see the predators and the herbivores actually together eating from the pile of food. And they'd be so full that they would play with one another. And so you'd see these wolves playing with rabbits, and the wolf would catch the rabbit and immediately let the rabbit go. And it's like they became best friends. So the conflict you saw between these different animals disappeared because they were eating such high-quality food from the cook. I mean, the cook was providing them with food way better than anything that they could get. So it was kind of interesting to watch all these animals gathered around, basically enjoying fellowship with one another and feeding on that pile. I never had to worry about the 600-pound bears, because as long as they're eating, they weren't going to bother me. So.
Yeah, when I was in Vietnam, we had a dump nearby. We put the garbage, and tigers would go there and eat out of it.
Yeah.
So it kept things a little safer for us.
It did, yeah. So, incidentally, they had to shut down that telescope because the engineers there basically said, well, the cook gets isolation pay. We want isolation pay. And the government says, we're not going to give it to you. And so they basically shut the whole observatory. It still ranks as one of the world's best radio telescopes. But for over 40 years, it's been mothballed. And which tells you, be careful where you put a telescope because the support staff may not like to live there. And hey, I loved the period of the 10 and a half months of winter because there were no flies biting me. I hated to go there in summer. That was awful. And you want to know how awful? I'm running out of time. But I was with this American astronomer once, and we were driving a vehicle, and it was just this huge cloud of black flies, so thick that you couldn't see outside the windshield. He was going to turn the windshield wiper on. I said, stop, don't do that, because you're going to just have all these squashed black flies there, and we're not going to be able to see a thing outside the window. At least now we can see 3 or 4 feet out the window. And so just drive very slowly and don't turn on those windshield wipers. Americans can't believe that it ever gets that bad. It really does get that bad. But it only lasts 2 weeks. Yes?
For that facility, maybe the solution is just find cheaper chefs.
Find cheaper what?
Chefs.
Find cheaper chefs.
Yeah. And other people won't feel so bad and not make any money
with the chefs. Well, I'll tell you one little story about that. Because they had to give this chef 3 weeks vacation. And I happened to be on the telescope when the main chef was on vacation. So they brought this guy in for 3 weeks. So I was observing 24 hours a day, and it was a 6-day run. I was younger back then. I could handle that. I couldn't do that now. But I remember talking to the cook saying, look, I can't come to the dining hall. I'm going to be stuck at the control desk of the telescope the entire time. And so I need for you to make me lunches. And he says, well, how many lunches do you need? Well, I said, I'm going to need 5 a day because I'm not going to be sleeping. So please, I'm going to need 5 lunches a day. And I just have them, one of the engineers bring it. Okay, I get on the telescope. I'm on the telescope for 2 hours. 6 days of lunches arrive all at once. And the engineer who's working with me says, tell you what, how about if I trade my lunch for your lunch, sight unseen? Evidently, he'd been there. He knew what was happening. So I said, sure, you can pick any one of my lunches. I'll trade you for your lunch. So he immediately opens up my lunch and he says, bologna sandwiches. And so I looked at all, I had 30, no, it was actually, yeah, 30 lunches there. We opened up every bag was bologna sandwiches. Bologna sandwiches on white bread, that's all I had to eat for that whole week. There was almost a riot that broke out at the observatory because they said, you know, can't you get the cook to cut his vacation and come back? Pay him extra, whatever you got to do. We can't handle this guy just giving his bologna sandwiches all the time. So yeah, for a 6-day period, all I had to eat was bologna sandwiches. But what was fun is every time the engineer would come, I would get a different engineer for every shift. And each engineer would say, can I trade? Because they all thought there's no way they're going to give the astronomers the same food we're eating, right? So I always would trade with them and I'd get the same reaction. Oh, no. So yeah, you get what you pay for. That chef came cheap, but boy, we got what we paid for. All right, let's see him out of time. All right. Okay, I got a question for you for next week, because you know we're trying to wrap this up, get through Ecclesiastes 12. We're actually going to spend some time on Ecclesiastes 11, because it's... So I want you to read all of Ecclesiastes 11 and 12, and I want you to think about applying this in the context of evangelism and apologetics. I mean, you got phrases like cast your bread upon the waters, and basically it's saying diversify your investments. Well, actually what I'm going to suggest is this is a text that's telling us, based on the context of the rest of the book, because I mentioned the theme of the book is this is a playbook on how to reach atheists that think there is no God. That's what this whole book is all about. So I want you to interpret Genesis 11 and 12 in that context. If we're really serious about reaching people who think there is no God, and it's not just atheists, I'd say agnostics are in that category. A lot of deists actually live their lives if there is no God. How are we going to reach these folks? You're going to have to reach them with a diversified portfolio of apologetics tools. So I want you to think about that. And then as we move on, for those of you especially a little bit younger in the class, notice the theme, remember your Creator when you're young. The time to get serious about this is not when you're 50 years of age. The time to get serious about this is when you're 10, 12, 15, 20. And so we're going to get into why it's so important that we give this serious attention when we're young and not wait till we're older. But we're going to also finish up this theme about how it is God knows all your thoughts and all your motives, and we need to live our lives accordingly. I'm going to give you a couple of cross-reference passages to look at, and ones we haven't studied yet, which is basically Hebrews 4, verse 10, Isaiah 40, verse 27. But next week, I got a question for all of you. Because this is all talking about the fact that God not only knows all your thoughts and your motives, He knows your fears and your doubts. And this is a big factor in evangelism and apologetics, identifying the fear and the doubt of people you're talking to. And incidentally, a lot of Christians struggle with fears and doubts. And so I want you to think back in your past. Is there a doubt that you experience that caused you some fear about God's care about your life and His role in your life? And I know every one of you can answer that question with yes, but I'm giving you a whole week to think about. Think of a significant period in your life when a doubt was crippling you in terms of generating fear, anxiety. Maybe fear is not the right word. Did you ever have a doubt that caused you some anxiety about your own walk with the Lord, but about your witness? Because when you got an anxiety like that, it tends to blunt your willingness to engage others with your Christian faith. So I want to hear some testimonies next week.
Can you give those passages
again? Let me give you the passages again. Isaiah 40, verse 27, and then Hebrews 4, 10, and of course Hebrews 11, 6, and the passage we're looking at is 1 Chronicles 29, 8, 9, and 10. And then the last two verses of Ecclesiastes, chapter 12, last two verses. And all those texts are basically making a point. We humans think God gets tired and weary and therefore doesn't pay attention to everything that's going on in her life. And these are texts that basically says God rests, but he never gets tired, he never gets weary, he knows everything that's going on in your life. Every second of your life, he knows exactly how you feel. Which is why we've been saying weeks past, don't try to hide your feelings from God. He knows how you feel. Be upfront, be honest. If you've got doubts, you need to tell him. And he wants you to come to you and with your fears and your doubts because he wants to deal with them. When you hide, he can't help you. And so basically the exhortation is, how can we stop hiding from God? Number one, realize, first of all, you can't hide, so why try hiding? That'll be next week. Let me close in prayer. Father in heaven, we thank you for this time we've had in class today. Thank you for all the diversions we had, and Lord, how that's going to equip us to be more effective in sharing our faith with others. We thank you for this wonderful season we're entering into with Thanksgiving and Christmas, opportunities we're going to have like no other time of the year to be a witness for you. So help us to be well prepared. Help us to be gracious and loving with everyone we do engage, that your love, your truth, and life might penetrate hearts into salvation. In Jesus' name, amen. Thank you.